is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. He was once the fresh new face of Boston politics. He mirrored the fresh new face of the city. Young, a minority, smart, and serious about change. But for as far as he went, former city councilor Sam Yoon couldn't quite crack the old and recalcitrant fortress of City Hall. He lost his bid for mayor, and now Sam Yoon is leaving the city. We'll ask him why a little later this hour. And on cracks in fortresses, how secure do you think your residential wireless network really is? We'll take a look at the latest in how Google's Street View program was collecting private information off of Massachusetts home networks and what the state aims to do about it. Call us on either of these topics, Sam Yoon or Google, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But first, today's news of alleged Russian spies haunting Harvard Square put us in mind of this. The great Richard Burton in the 1965 movie version of John le Carré's novel, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
What the hell do you think spies are? Moral philosophers measuring everything they do against the word of God or Karl Marx? They're not. They're just a bunch of seedy, squalid bastards like me. Little men, drunkards, queers, henpecked husbands, civil servants playing cowboys and Indians to brighten their rotten little lives. You think they sit like monks in a cell, balancing right against wrong?
Well, this afternoon, Donald Howard Heathfield and Tracy Leanne Foley are indeed sitting in a cell, albeit one in federal prison. The Cambridge couple are two of 11 people charged with infiltrating American society for Russia while allegedly on deep cover assignments to spy on U.S. policymakers. However, Heathfield and Foley have not been charged with espionage, but with, quote, conspiracy to act as an agent of a foreign government without notifying the U.S. Attorney General. Joining us now is someone who went to school with one of the accused spies, Craig Sandler. He is owner of the Statehouse News Service and a regular guest on Radio Boston. He was also a classmate of Donald Heathfield at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Hi there, Craig. How are you doing?
Pretty well, Meghna. Good to be here, sort of.
So how is it that you met Donald Heathfield?
Well, really just the same way I met everybody else in the program. It's a, you know, a mid-career administration program, and you show up in the summer, do an orientation and six classes, and then you have an academic year, at the end of which you get a master's degree. So met him through classes, through speakers, through the normal run of events at the Kennedy School. And like a lot of people there, he was terrific to be with.
Craig, other people who've worked with him before described him as very bright. He says he was originally from Canada, bilingual in French and English. What kind of person did he strike you as?
It was always a pleasure to see him. We were not terribly close friends, but we kept in touch and we were steady acquaintances and would see each other once or twice a year. And there's a reason that I was always happy to see him, is that he was charming and well-spoken and soft-spoken and funny. He had a little goofy kind of sense of humor. There's nothing specific that comes immediately to mind, but he would just have a kind of a wry or a quirky way of commenting on people and the events of the day. So he was just, I don't know if there is a typical person at the Kennedy School, but he was just a well-spoken and intelligent, charming friend of mine.
Craig, looks like we have you on a very, very shaky cell phone line, so I'm just going to ask you one last quick question here. Did you ever get the sense, I mean, everyone at the Kennedy School is interested in politics and policy of some kind, but beyond that, looking back, did you ever get any sense that maybe there was a little bit more to Donald Howard Heathfield than you originally thought?
Well, he ran this enterprise called Future Map Company, and Future Map is something that we would talk about every time I saw him, and it was supposedly a sophisticated analytical modeling operation dedicated to solving the problems of the world. And if that sounds a little odd and a little ambiguous, it was. And you never really got to the bottom of it exactly, which was fine. I mean, there's a lot of interesting people doing interesting things at the Kennedy School and throughout academia, so it wasn't suspicious, it wasn't shady, but it was a little bit vague. So sure, in retrospect, it's easy to see that there was perhaps more to it than that, and there was definitely this somewhat inexplicable side to him, at least to his work.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the other hand, having taken a couple classes at the Kennedy School myself, I can say a lot of the things you learn there initially don't really make much sense in practical terms, but it is the seedbed of future policy. On the other hand, Craig Sandler, owner of State House News Service and a former classmate of accused spy Donald Howard Heathfield, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, look forward to the next time. Bye, Megan.
Bye, Craig. Well, the arrest of Heathfield, his wife, alleged wife Foley, and nine other alleged Russian spies comes just days after a high-profile meeting between President Barack Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. The leaders convened in Washington as part of Obama's latest push to reset relations with Moscow. Here's the president at a joint press conference just last week.
Indeed, I firmly believe that America's most significant national security interests and priorities could be advanced most effectively through cooperation, not an adversarial relationship with Russia. That's why I committed to resetting the relationship between our two nations, to deepen Russia's integration into the global economy.
Joining us now to talk about what impact the alleged spy ring might have on those resetting U.S.-Russia relations is Marshall Goldman. He's senior scholar at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. Professor Goldman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Let me ask you briefly, the Russian government's reacting fairly strongly to this. The Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement today, we don't understand the reasons which prompted the U.S. Department of Justice to make a public statement in the spirit of Cold War-era spy stories. So your take on how, if at all, this could be affecting these sort of the new era of U.S.-Russia relations?
To say the least, it's not going to help. I mean, this raises the whole question. What's been going on with the last couple months, couple of weeks? As you just reported, President of Obama said we want to have better relations, and then we have this kind of thing going on right in the middle of it. But if you have a Cold War mentality like I have, it makes you say, my goodness, who's trying to sabotage what? And you could very well ask the question, are there people in Washington or Moscow or any place who are to say, we don't like the way things are going and we're going to sabotage them by bringing up all these Cold War memories.
Now, federal documents that were also unsealed when the indictment was revealed just today alleges that the Russian government sent people like Donald Howard Heathfield and Tracy Ann Foley, allegedly, to the United States to, quote, you know, get information on some of Obama's goals, what he expects to achieve during the summit in last July in 2009, and how his team plans to do it, and what forms of persuasion they might use to, quote, lure Russia into cooperating with U.S. interests. Why is it that this kind of intelligence, which seems very policy-oriented and not necessarily, you know, secret plans for our next generation of bunker busters, what value is it to the Russian government?
It's bizarre. I don't know. It seems to me it would be much cheaper for them simply to type into Google and ask those very same questions. Why do you have to send people over here in deep depth espionage to try to do that? So it's just, if you look at it coldly and logically, it just, none of it seems to make sense either from the Russian side or from our side.
So you don't believe that it would give them any sort of negotiating advantage to understand maybe some of the minds behind these policies that the Obama administration might be trying to form?
Well, they seem to think so. I mean, it's hard for me to determine what in the world they could be getting that they couldn't pick up by reading the New York Times or the Washington Post or listening to your program. I don't know. It's a mystery. It really is a mystery.
Marshall Goldman, let me ask you then about where the particularities of where U.S.-Russia relations stand right now, because we just recently had the renegotiation of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, a very important treaty between the U.S. and Russia. There seems to be new cooperation over Afghanistan and other areas globally. And President Obama says he supports Russia's ascension to the World Trade Organization. So, on the Russian side of things, do you see that same level of cooperation?
Well, the Russians, you know, I'm distrustful of the Russians, but they do seem to be going along with these kinds of things, partly because they seem to be getting something out of it as a relaxation of the Cold War tensions. And there's another aspect of it that should also be mentioned, I think, and that is that both of us are concerned by Islamic terrorism. And that's what the two sides have been cooperating on. I mean, I know there's intelligence been exchanged on behalf of both sides for that kind of information. And the Russians have had their problems more serious than we have, although our problems certainly you can't minimize.
Now, I wonder if you could actually put this in some sort of historical context for us, because as you mentioned earlier, maybe an old cold warrior like you looks askance on this type of espionage. But what makes it different from the type of spying that we did see 50 years ago?
Well, you didn't have the Gorbachev or anybody else like that, much less Brezhnev, coming into the United States, being received so warmly in the White House. We did have summit meetings, and I can remember when Gorbachev came and we had the first summit meeting there with George Bush. This was really big news. Whereas today, we just kind of take it for granted that Medvedev will come, meet with Obama, and the two of them will get together and exchange greetings and talk. That just didn't seem to happen easily in the old days.
What kind of intelligence were spies trying to collect 50 years ago versus today?
Well, 50 years ago, you were trying to get everything. I mean, whether nuclear weapons, industrial technology. I mean, there were special efforts trying to figure out what we were producing because we had technology the Russians didn't have, miniaturization, the whole... Almost everything we were doing, they were interested in doing. Now they don't have to use espionage to get that. They can just, say, open up the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, or I say, Google.
Do you, I mean, you're a Harvard man yourself, spend a lot of time up there. It seems to me, though, that there has been a long-term relationship between spy agencies and the highest levels of academe. I mean, I just looked, for example, at members of the Obama administration who were recently at Harvard, and there are actually, you know, there are dozens of names. The most famous, of course, being Larry Summers, former Harvard president. He's now President Obama's top economic advisor. Ash Carter, formerly at the Belfer Center. He's now an undersecretary for technology and logistics. Juliet Kayyem, also formerly at the Belfer Center. She was our homeland security head right here in Massachusetts, and now she's assistant secretary of homeland security for intergovernmental programs. And the list goes on and on. Sure. My point being is that there's been a longstanding relationship between academe and policymakers. So does it make sense?
And
intelligence.
Yes.
All the way back to the founding of the CIA. But does it make sense to you that for whatever reason the Russians might find this policy intelligence valuable, that they would come here to Cambridge?
Well, I think, they certainly would want to come here to Cambridge, but I'm not sure I think they would be better advised to go to Washington and New York, and Cambridge, it's much nicer, it's quieter, and it's more relaxing. But, I mean, in terms of taking home a richer bag of intelligence, I think that they would do better there. Maybe I'm just missing it all, but I don't see what we have going on here. In times past, during the technology breakthrough that there was an industrial technology that indeed was worth spying on. But I don't think we're at that stage today. And so why they come here for that is really a bit of a mystery.
Just one last question to you, Marshall Goldman. I mean, former Russian President Vladimir Putin, of course, was very famously with the KGB.
Right.
And I just wonder if whether or not what we're seeing here, and this is pure speculation on my part, but I'm curious if you could put us in the mind of Russian government officials, that even though we do have the end of the Cold War, technically we're allies, the United States and Russia, we're kind of prickly allies.
Yes. Yes.
So there's still a sense of competition, and maybe Russia still continues to feel that whatever it can understand about the motivations of the United States at any level is valuable.
Well, I suspect, I'm sure that's the case, and I'm sure, as you say, Putin, after all, was in the KGB and was very active and certainly has that kind of mentality. So I'm sure there are people there who are pushing this kind of concern, of effort. I'm saying that, let's send over spies. Maybe we can find something. But, if you look at it at a cost-benefit basis, you have to say the cost is pretty high. And it's very hard to see what the benefits are relative to what else you could be getting elsewhere.
Well, Marshall Goldman, thank you so much for your time today.
Sure, thank you.
Marshall Goldman is senior scholar at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. One little interesting thing to note, the FBI's investigation of this alleged Russian spy ring kicked into high gear when one of the suspects supposedly sat in a New York coffee shop and used a laptop and a wireless network to communicate with other alleged operatives who were driving a car nearby. Call it Cold War driving. It's not a far leap from war driving, a real term computer hackers use to describe the kind of spying they do when they drive around and peer into home wireless networks, kind of like what Google recently did, both around the world and right here in Massachusetts. So when we come back, the fallacy of wireless privacy in the age of Google and what Massachusetts might do about it. Join us with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.